face, and human faces were the last of the human codes that I would learn. She inhaled. How are you feeling? I don't know. I don't remember a lot of things. My mind is a little bit scrambled, especially about this morning. Listen, has anyone been to my office since yesterday? This confused her. I don't know. How would I know that? I doubt very much they'll be in at the weekend. And anyway, you're the only one who has the keys. Please, Andrew, what happened? Have you suffered an accident? Have they tested you for amnesia? Why were you out of the house at that time? Tell me what you were doing. I woke up and you weren't there.
I just needed to get out. That is all. I needed to be outside.
She was agitated now. I was thinking all sorts of things. I checked the whole house, but there was no sign of you. And the car was still there, and your bike. And you weren't picking up your phone, and it was 3 in the morning, Andrew. 3 in the morning.
I nodded. She wanted answers, but I only had questions. Where is our son, Gulliver? Why is he not with you?
This answer confused her even more. He's at my mother's, she said. I could hardly bring him here. He's very upset. After everything else, this is, you know, hard for him.
Nothing she was telling me was information I needed, so I decided to be more direct. Do you know what I did yesterday? Do you know what I achieved while I was at work? I knew that, however she answered this, the truth remained the same. I would have to kill her. Not then. Not there. But somewhere, and soon. Still, I had to know what she knew, or what she might have said to others. The nurse wrote something down at this point. Isabel ignored my question and leant in closer towards me, lowering her voice.
They think you've suffered a mental breakdown. They don't call it that, of course, but that is what they think. I've been asked lots of questions. It was like facing the Grand Inquisitor.
That's all there is around here, isn't it? Questions?
I braved another glance at her face and gave her more questions.
Why did we get married? What is the point of it? What are the rules involved?
Certain inquiries, even on a planet designed for questions, go unheard. Andrew, I've been telling you for weeks, months, that you need to slow down. You've been overdoing it. Your hours have been ridiculous. You've been truly burning the candle. Something had to give. But even so, this was so sudden. There were no warning signs. I just want to know what triggered it all. Was it me? What was it? I'm worried about you.
I tried to come up with a valid explanation. I suppose I just must have forgotten the importance of wearing clothes. That is, the importance of acting the way I was supposed to act. I don't know. I must have just forgotten how to be a human. It can happen, can't it? Things can be forgotten sometimes.
Isabel held my hand. The glabrous under portion of her thumb stroked my skin. This unnerved me even more. I wondered why she was touching me.
A policeman grips an arm to take you somewhere.
But why does a wife stroke your hand? What was the purpose?
Did it have something to do with love? I stared at the small glistening diamond on her ring.
It's going to be all right, Andrew. This is just a blip. I promise you. You'll be right as rain soon.
As rain? I asked, the worry adding a quiver to my voice. I tried to read her facial expressions, but it was difficult. She wasn't terrified anymore, but what was she? Was she sad? Confused? Angry? Disappointed? I wanted to understand, but I couldn't. She left me after 100 more words of the conversation. Words, words, words. There was a brief kiss on my cheek and a hug, and I tried not to flinch or tighten up, hard as that was for me. And then she turned away and wiped something from her eye, which had leaked. I felt like I was expected to do something, say something, feel something, but I didn't know what.
I saw your book, I said, in the shop, next to mine. Some of you still remains, then, she said. The tone was soft, but slightly scornful, or I think it was. Andrew, just be careful. Do everything they say and it will be all right.
everything will be all right.
And then she was gone. Dead cows. I was told to go to the dining hall to eat. This was a terrible experience. For one thing, it was the first time I had been confronted with so many of their species in an enclosed area. Second, the smell of boiled carrot, of pea, of dead cow. A cow is an earth-dwelling animal, a domesticated and multi-purpose ungulate, which humans treat as a one-stop shop for food, liquid refreshment, fertilizer, and designer footwear. The humans farm it and cut its throat and then cut it up and package it and refrigerate it and sell it and cook it. By doing this, apparently they have earned the right to change its name to beef, which is the monosyllable furthest away from cow, because the last thing a human wants to think about when eating cow is an actual cow. I didn't care about cows. If it had been my assignment to kill a cow, then I would have happily done so. But there was a leap to be made from not caring about someone to wanting to eat them. So I ate the vegetables, or rather, I ate a single slice of boiled carrot. Nothing, I realized, could make you feel quite so homesick as eating disgusting, unfamiliar food. One slice was enough. More than enough. It was, in fact, far too much, and it took me all my strength and concentration to battle that gag reflex and not throw up. I sat on my own, at a table in the corner, beside a tall pot plant. The plant had broad, shining, rich, green, flat vascular organs known as leaves, which evidently served a photosynthetic function. It looked exotic to me, but not appallingly so. Indeed, the plant looked rather pretty. For the first time, I was looking at something here and not being troubled. But then I looked away from the plant, towards the noise, and all the humans classified as crazy, the ones for whom the ways of this world were beyond them. If I was ever going to relate to anyone on this planet, they were surely going to be in this room. And just as I was thinking this, one of them came up to me, a girl with short pink hair and a circular piece of silver through her nose, as if that region of the face needed more attention given to it. Thin orange-pink scars on her arms, and a quiet, low voice that seemed to imply that every thought in her brain was a deadly secret. She was wearing a T-shirt. On the T-shirt were the words, "Everything was beautiful, and nothing hurt." Her name was Zoe. She told me that straight away. The world as will and representation. And then she said,
"New?"
"Yes," I said.
"Day?"
"Yes," I said. "It is. We do appear to be angled towards the sun." She laughed, and her laughter was the opposite of her voice. It was a kind of laugh that made me wish there was no air for those manic waves to travel on and reach my ears. Once she had calmed down, she explained herself.
"No, I mean, are you here permanently, or do you just come in for the day? Like me, a voluntary commitment job."
"I don't know," I said. "I think I will be leaving soon. I'm not mad, you see. I have just been a little confused about things. I have a lot to get on with. Things to do. Things to finish off."
"I recognize you from somewhere," said Zoe.
"Do you? From where?" I scanned the room. I was starting to feel uncomfortable. There were 76 patients and 18 members of staff. I needed privacy. I needed really to get out of there.
"Have you been on the telly?"
"I don't know." She laughed.
"We might be Facebook friends."
"Yeah." She scratched her horrible face. I wondered what was underneath. It couldn't have been any worse. And then her eyes widened with a realization.
"No, I know. I've seen you at uni. You're Professor Martin, aren't you? You're something of a legend. I'm at Fitzwilliam. I've seen you around the place. Better food in hall than here, isn't it?"
"Are you one of my students?" She laughed again.
"No, no. GCSE maths was enough for me. I hated it."
This angered me. "Hated it? How can you hate mathematics? Mathematics is everything."
"Well, I didn't see it like that. I mean, Pythagoras sounded like a bit of a dude, but no, I'm not really uber big on numbers. I'm philosophy. That's probably why I'm in here.
OD'd on Schopenhauer.
Schopenhauer?
He wrote a book called The World as Will and Representation. I'm meant to be doing an essay on it. Basically, it says that the world is what we recognise in our own will. Humans are ruled by their basic desires, and this leads to suffering and pain, because our desires make us crave things from the world, but the world is nothing but representation. Because those same cravings shape what we see, we end up feeding from ourselves until we go mad, and end up in here.
Do you like it in here?
She laughed again, but I noticed her kind of laughing somehow made her look sadder. No, this place is a whirlpool. It sucks you deeper. You want out of this place, man. Everyone in here is off the charts, I tell you.
She pointed at various people in the room and told me what was wrong with them. She started with an oversized, red-faced female at the nearest table to us.
That's Fat Anna. She steals everything. Look at her with a fork. Straight up her sleeve. Oh, and that's Scott. He thinks he's third in line to the throne. And Sarah, who is totally normal for most of the day, and then at 4:15 starts screaming for no reason. Got to have a screamer. And that's crying Chris. And there's Bridget the Fidget, who's always moving around at the speed of thought.
The speed of thought, I said. That's slow.
And Lying Lisa. And Rockin' Rajesh. Oh, yeah. And you see that guy over there with the sideburns? The tall one, mumbling to his tray?
Yes.
Well, he's gone the full K-Pax.
What?
He's so cracked he thinks he's from another planet.
No, I said. Really?
Yeah, trust me. In this canteen, we're just one mute Native American away from a full cuckoo's nest.
I had no idea what she was talking about. She looked at my plate.
Are you not eating that?
No, I said. I don't think I could. And then, thinking I might get some information out of her, I asked, if I had done something, achieved something remarkable, do you think I would have told a lot of people? I mean, we humans are proud, aren't we? We like to show off about things.
Yes, I suppose.
I nodded, felt panic rising as I wondered how many people knew about Professor Andrew Martin's discovery. Then I decided to broaden my inquiry. To act like a human, I would, after all, need to understand them. So I asked her the biggest question I could think of. What do you think the meaning of life is, then? Did you discover it?
Ha! The meaning of life. The meaning of life. There is none. People search for external values and meaning in a world which not only can't provide it, but is also indifferent to their quest. That's not really Schopenhauer, that's more Kierkegaard via Camus. I'm with them. Trouble is, if you study philosophy and stop believing in a meaning, you start to need medical help.
What about love? What is love all about? I read about it, in Cosmopolitan. Another laugh.
Cosmopolitan? Are you joking?
No. Not at all. I want to understand these things.
You're definitely asking the wrong person here. See, that's one of my problems.
She lowered her voice by at least 2 octaves, stared darkly.
I like violent men. I don't know why. It's a kind of self-harm thing. I go to Peterborough a lot. Rich pickings.
Oh, I said, realizing it was right I'd been sent here. The humans were as weird as I'd been told, and as in love with violence. So love is about finding the right person to hurt you?
Pretty much.
That doesn't make sense.
There is always some madness in love, but there is also always some reason in madness. That was someone.
There was a silence. I wanted to leave. Not knowing the etiquette, I just stood up and left. She released a little whine, and then laughed again. Laughter, like madness, seemed to be the only way out, the emergency exit for humans. I went over optimistically to the man mumbling to his tray, the apparent extraterrestrial. I spoke to him for a while. I asked him with considerable hope where he was from. He said Tatooine, a place I had never heard of. He said he lived near the Great Pit of Carcoon, a short drive from Jabba's palace. He used to live with the Skywalkers on their farm
but it burned down. How far away is your planet? From Earth, I mean.
Very far.
How far?
50,000 miles, he said,
crushing my hope and making me wish I'd never diverted my attention away from the plant with the lush green leaves. I looked at him. For a moment I'd thought I wasn't alone among them, but now I knew I was. So, I thought to myself as I walked away, this is what happens when you live on Earth. You crack. You hold reality in your hands until it burns, and then you have to drop the plate. Someone somewhere else in the room, just as I was thinking this, actually did drop a plate. Yes, I could see it now. Being a human sent you insane. I looked out of a large glass rectangular window and saw trees and buildings, cars and people. Clearly, this was a species not capable of handling the new plate Andrew Martin had just handed them. I really needed to get out of there and do my duty. I thought of Isabel, my wife. She had knowledge, the kind of knowledge I needed. I should have left with her. What am I doing? I walked towards the window, expecting it to be like windows on my planet, Vonadoria, but it wasn't. It was made of glass, which was made of rock, and instead of walking through it, I banged my nose into it, prompting a few yelps of laughter from other patients. I left the room, quite desperate to escape all the people and the smell of cow and carrots. Amnesia. Acting human was one thing, but if Andrew Martin had told people, then I really could not afford to waste any more time in this place. Looking at my left hand and the gifts it contained, I knew what I had to do. After lunch, I visited the nurse who had sat watching me talk to Isabel. I lowered my voice to just the right frequency. I slowed the words to just the right speed. To hypnotize a human was easy, because out of any species in the universe, they seemed the one most desperate to believe. I am perfectly sane. I would like to see the doctor who can discharge me. I really need to get back home to see my wife and child, and to continue my work at Fitzwilliam College, Cambridge University. Plus, I really don't like the food here. I don't know what happened this morning, I really don't. It was an embarrassing public display, but I wholeheartedly assure you that whatever it was I suffered, it was temporary. I am sane now, and I am happy. I feel very well indeed. He nodded. Follow me, he said. The doctor wanted me to have some medical tests, a brain scan. They were worried about possible damage to my cerebral cortex, which could have prompted amnesia. I realized whatever else was to occur, the one thing that couldn't possibly happen to me was to have my brain looked at, not while the gifts were active. So I convinced him I was not suffering from amnesia. I made up a lot of memories. I made up a whole life. I told him that I'd been under a lot of pressure at work, and he understood. He then asked me some more questions. But as with all human questions, the answers were always there, inside them, like protons inside an atom, for me to locate and give as my own independent thoughts. After half an hour, the diagnosis was clear. I hadn't lost my memory. I had simply suffered a period of temporary insanity. Although he disapproved of the term breakdown, he said I had suffered a mental collapse due to sleep deprivation and work pressures and a diet which, as Isabel had already informed the doctor, consisted largely of strong black coffee, a drink, of course, I already knew I hated. The doctor then gave me some prompts, wondering if I'd suffered from panic attacks, low moods, nervous jolts, sudden behavioural swings, or feelings of unreality. Unreality, I could ponder with conviction. Oh, yes, I have definitely been feeling that one. But not any more. I feel fine. I feel very real. I feel as real as the sun. The doctor smiled. He told me he'd read one of my books on mathematics, an apparently really funny memoir of Andrew Martin's time teaching at Princeton University, the book I had seen already, the the one called American Pie. He wrote me a prescription for more diazepam and advised I take things one day at a time, as if there were another way for days to be experienced. And then he picked up the most primitive piece of telecommunications technology I'd ever seen and told Isabel to come and take me home. Remember, during your mission, never to become influenced or corrupted. The humans are an arrogant species, defined by violence and greed. They have taken their home planet, the only one they currently have access to, and placed it on the road to destruction. They have created a world of divisions and categories, and have continually failed to see the similarities between themselves. They have developed technology at a rate too fast for human psychology to keep up with, and yet they still pursue advancement for advancement's sake, and for the pursuit of the money and fame they all crave so much. You must never fall into the human's trap. You must never look at an individual and fail to see their relation to the crimes of the whole. Every smiling human face hides the terrors they are all capable of and are all responsible for, however indirectly. You must never soften or shrink from your task. Stay pure. Retain your logic. Do not let anyone interfere with the mathematical certainty of what needs to be done. 4 Campion Row. It was a warm room. There was a window, but the curtains were drawn. They were thin enough for electromagnetic radiation from the only sun to filter through, and I could see everything clear enough. The walls were painted sky blue, and there was an incandescent light bulb hanging down from the ceiling with a cylindrical shade made of paper. I was lying in bed. It was a large square bed made for two people. I had been lying asleep in this same bed for over 3 hours, and now I was awake. It was Professor Andrew Martin's bed on the second floor of his house. His house was at 4 Campion Row. It was large compared to the exteriors of other houses I had seen. Inside, all the walls were white. Downstairs, in the hallway and the kitchen, the floor was made of limestone, which was made of calcite, and so provided something familiar for me to look at. The kitchen, where I had gone to drink some water, was especially warm owing to the presence of something called an oven. This particular type of oven was made of iron and powered by gas, with two continually hot disks on its top surface. It was called an arger. It was cream-coloured. There were lots of doors in the kitchen, and also here in the bedroom. Oven doors and cupboard doors and wardrobe doors. Whole worlds shut away. The bedroom had a beige carpet made of wool. Animal hair. There was a poster on the wall which had a picture of two human heads, one male and one female, very close together. It had the words Roman Holiday on it. Other words, too. Words like Gregory Peck and Audrey Hepburn and Paramount Pictures. There was a photograph on top of a wooden cuboid piece of furniture. A photograph is basically a two-dimensional, non-moving holograph, catering only to the sense of sight. This photograph was inside a rectangle of steel. A photograph of Andrew and Isabel. They were younger, their skins more radiant and unwithered. Isabel looked happy because she was smiling, and a smile is a signifier of human happiness. In the photograph, Andrew and Isabel were standing on grass. She was wearing a white dress. It seemed to be the dress to wear if you wanted to be happy. There was another photo. They were standing somewhere hot. Neither of them had dresses on. They were among giant, crumbling stone columns under a perfectly blue sky, an important building from a former human civilization. On Earth, incidentally, civilization is the result of a group of humans coming together and suppressing their instincts. The civilization, I guessed, was one that must have been neglected or destroyed. They were smiling, but this was a different kind of smile, and one which was confined to their mouths and not their eyes. They looked uncomfortable, though I attributed this to the heat on their thin skin. Then there was a later photograph, taken indoors somewhere. They had a child with them. Young. Male. He had hair as dark as his mother, maybe darker, with paler skin. He was wearing an item of clothing which said, Cowboy. Isabel was there in the room a lot of the time, either sleeping beside me or standing nearby watching. Mostly I tried not to look at her. I didn't want to connect to her in any way. It would not serve my mission well if any kind of sympathy or even empathy towards her were to form. Admittedly, this was unlikely. Her very otherness troubled me. She was so alien. But the universe was unlikely before it happened, and it had almost indisputably happened. Though I did brave her eyes for one question. When did you last see me? I mean, before. Yesterday?
At breakfast. And then you were at work. You came home at 11, in bed by 11:30.
Did I say anything to you? Did I tell you anything?
You've said my name, but I pretended to be sleeping, and that was it. Until I woke up and you were gone.
I smiled. Relieved, I suppose. But back then I didn't quite understand why.
The War and Money Show. I watched the television she had brought in for me. She had struggled with it. It was heavy for her. I think she expected me to help her. It seemed so wrong, watching a biological life form putting herself through such effort. I was confused and wondered why she would do it for me. I attempted, out of sheer telekinetic curiosity, to lighten it for her with my mind.
That was easier than I was expecting, she said.
Oh, I said, catching her gaze face on. Well, expectation is a funny thing.
You still like to watch the news, don't you?
Watch the news. That was a very good idea. The news might have something for me. Yes, I said. I like to watch the news. I watched it, and Isabel watched me, both equally troubled by what we saw. The news was full of human faces, but generally smaller ones and often at a great distance away. Within my first hour of watching, I discovered three interesting details. 1. The term news on Earth generally meant news that directly affects humans. There was, quite literally, nothing about the antelope or the seahorse or the red-eared slider turtle or the other 9 million species on the planet. 2. The news was prioritized in a way I could not understand. For instance, there was nothing on new mathematical observations or still undiscovered polygons, but quite a bit about politics, which on this planet was essentially all about war and money. Indeed, war and money seemed to be so popular on the news, it should more accurately be described as the War and Money Show. I had been told right. This was a planet characterized by violence and greed. A bomb had exploded in a country called Afghanistan. Elsewhere, people were worrying about the nuclear capability of North Korea. So-called stock markets were falling. This worried a lot of humans, who gazed up at screens full of numbers, studying them as if they displayed the only mathematics that mattered. Oh, and I waited for the stuff on the Riemann hypothesis, but nothing came. This was either because no one knew, or no one cared. Both possibilities were, in theory, comforting, and yet I did not feel comforted. 3. Humans cared more about things if they were happening closer to them. South Korea worried about North Korea. People in London were worried chiefly about the cost of houses in London. It seemed people didn't mind someone being naked in a rainforest so long as it was nowhere near their lawn. And they didn't care at all about what was happening beyond their solar system, and very little about what was happening inside it, except with what was happening right here on Earth. Admittedly, not a great deal was happening in their solar system, which might have gone some way to explain where human arrogance came from, a lack of competition. Mostly, humans just wanted to know about what was going on within their country, preferably within that bit of the country which was their bit. The more local, the better. Given this view, the absolutely ideal human news programme would only concern what was going on inside the house where the human watching it actually lived. The coverage could then be divided up and prioritised on the basis of the specific rooms within that house, with the lead story always being about the room where the television was, and typically concerning the most important fact that it was being watched by a human. But until a human follows the logic of news to this inevitable conclusion, the best they had was local news. So, in Cambridge, the most important thing on the news was the story about the human called Professor Andrew Martin, who was discovered walking unclothed around the grounds of the new court at Corpus Christi College, Cambridge University, during the early hours of that morning. The repeated coverage of this last detail also explained why the telephone had been ringing almost continuously since I had arrived, and why my wife had been talking about emails arriving into the computer all the time. "I've been fielding them," she told me. "I've told them you aren't up to talking right now and that you are too ill."
"Oh." She sat on the bed, stroked my hand some more. My skin crawled. A part of me wished I could just end her right there. But there was a sequence, and it had to be followed.
"Everyone's worried about you."
"Who?" I said.
"Well, your son, for a start. Gulliver's got even worse since this."
"We only have one child."
Her eyelids descended slowly. Her face was a tableau of forced calm.
"You know we do, and I really don't understand how you left without a brain scan."
"They decided I didn't need one. It was quite easy."
I tried to eat a bit of the food she'd placed by the side of the bed, something called a cheese sandwich. Another thing humans had to thank cows for. It was bad, but edible.
"Why did you make me this?" I asked.
"I'm looking after you," she said.
A moment's confusion. It was slow to compute. But then I realized, where we were used to service technology, humans had each other.
"But what's in it for you?"
She laughed.
"That question's been a constant our whole marriage."
"Why?" I said. "Has our marriage been a bad one?"
She took a deep breath, as if the question was something she had to swim under.
"Just eat your sandwich, Andrew."
A stranger. I ate my sandwich. Then I thought of something else.
"Is that normal? To have just one? Child, I mean."
"It's about the only thing that is, right now."
She scratched a little bit at her hand. Just a tiny bit. But it still made me think of that woman, Zoe, at the mental hospital, with the scars on her arms and the violent boyfriends and the head full of philosophy. There was a long silence. I was accustomed to silence, having lived alone most of my life, but somehow this silence was a different kind. It was the kind you needed to break.
"Thank you," I said, "for the sandwich. I liked it. The bread, anyway."
I didn't honestly know why I said this, as I hadn't enjoyed the sandwich. And yet it was the first time in my life I had thanked anyone for anything. She smiled.
"Don't get used to it, Emperor."
And then she patted her hand on my chest and rested it there. I noticed a shift in her eyebrows and an extra crease arrive in her forehead.
"That's odd," she said.
"What?"
"Your heart. It feels irregular, and like it's hardly beating."
She took her hand away, stared at her husband for a moment as if he were a stranger, which of course he was. I was. Stranger, indeed, than she could ever know. She looked worried, too, and there was a part of me that resented it, even as I knew fear, of all the emotions, was precisely what she should have been feeling at that moment in time.
"I have to go to the supermarket," she told me. "We've got nothing in. Everything has gone off."
"Right," I said, wondering if I should allow this to happen. I supposed I had to. There was a special sequence to follow, and the start of that sequence was at Fitzwilliam College in Professor Andrew Martin's office. If Isabel left the house, then I could leave the house too without prompting any suspicion.
"All right," I said.
"But remember, you've got to stay in bed, okay?"
Just stay in bed and watch television.
Yes, I said. That is what I will do. I will stay in bed and watch television. She nodded, but her forehead remained creased. She left the room, and then she left the house. I got out of bed and stubbed my toe on the door frame. It hurt. That wasn't weird in itself, I suppose. The weird thing was it stayed hurting. Not a severe pain. I'd only stubbed my toe, after all. But it was a pain which wasn't being fixed. Or not until I walked out of the room and onto the landing, then it faded and disappeared with suspicious speed. Puzzled, I walked back into the bedroom. The pain increased the closer I got to the television, where a woman was talking about the weather, making predictions. I switched the television off, and the ache in the toe immediately disappeared. Strange. The signals must have interfered with the gifts, the technology I had inside my left hand. I left the room, vowing in times of crisis never to be anywhere near a television. I went downstairs. There were lots of rooms here. In the kitchen, there was a creature sleeping in a basket. It had four legs, and its body was entirely covered with brown and white hair. This was a dog, a male. He stayed lying there with his eyes closed, but growled when I entered the room. I was looking for a computer, but there was no computer in the kitchen. I went into another room, a square room at the back of the house, which I would soon learn was the sitting room, though most human rooms were sitting rooms, if the truth be told. There was a computer here, and a radio. I switched the radio on first. A man was talking about the films of another man called Werner Herzog. I punched the wall, and my fist hurt, but when I switched off the radio, it stopped hurting. Not just televisions, then. The computer was primitive. It had the words MacBook Pro on it, and a keypad full of letters and numbers, and a lot of arrows pointing in every possible direction. It seemed like a metaphor for human existence. A minute or so later, and I was accessing it, searching emails and documents, finding nothing on the Riemann hypothesis. I accessed the Internet, the prime source for information here. News of what Professor Andrew Martin had proved was nowhere to be found, though details of how to get to Fitzwilliam College were easy to access. Memorizing them, I took the largest batch of keys on the chest in the hallway, and then left the house. Starting the sequence. Most mathematicians would trade their soul with Mephistopheles for a proof of the Riemann hypothesis. Marcus du Sautoy. The woman on the television had told me there would be no rain, so I rode Professor Andrew Martin's bicycle to Fitzwilliam College. It was evening now. Isabel would be at the supermarket already, so I knew I didn't have long. It was a Sunday. Apparently this meant the college would be quiet, but I knew I had to be careful. I knew where to go, and although riding a bicycle was a relatively easy thing to do, I was still a bit confused by the laws of the roads and narrowly escaped accidents a couple of times. Eventually I made it to a long, quiet, tree-lined street called Stories Way and the college itself. I leant my bike against a wall and walked towards the main entrance of this, the largest of the three buildings. This was a wide, relatively modern example of Earth's architecture, three stories high. As I was entering the building, I passed a woman with a bucket and a mop, cleaning the wooden floor. "Hello," she said. She seemed to recognize me, though it wasn't a recognition that made her happy. I smiled. I had discovered at the hospital that smiling was the appropriate first response on greeting someone. Saliva had little to do with it. "Hello, I'm a professor here, Professor Andrew Martin. I know this sounds terribly strange, but I have suffered a little accident. Nothing major, but enough to cause me some short-term memory loss. Anyway, the point is I am off work for a little while, but I really need something in the office. My office. Something of purely personal value. Is there any chance you know where my office is?" She studied me for a couple of seconds. "I hope it wasn't anything serious," she said, though it didn't sound like the sincerest of hopes.
No, no, it wasn't. I fell off my bike. Anyway, I'm sorry, but I am a little bit pressed for time.
Upstairs, along the corridor. Second door on the left.
Thank you. I passed someone on the stairs. A grey-haired woman, astute-looking by human standards, with glasses hanging around her neck.
Andrew, she said. My goodness, how are you? And what are you doing? I heard you were unwell.
I studied her closely. I wondered how much she knew. Yes, I had a little bump on the head, but I am all right now. Honestly, don't worry, I've been checked out and I should be fine. As right as the rain.
Oh,
she said, unconvinced.
I see, I see, I see.
And then I asked, with a slight and inexplicable dread, an essential question. When did you last see me?
I haven't seen you all week. Must have been a week ago Thursday.
And we've had no other contact since then? Phone calls? Emails? Any other?
No. No, why would there have been? You've got me intrigued.
Oh, it's nothing. It's just this bump on my head. I'm all over the place.
Dear, that's terrible. Are you sure you should be here?
Shouldn't you be at home, in bed? Yes, probably I should. After this, I'm going home.
Good. Well, I hope you feel better soon.
Oh, thank you.
Bye.
She continued downstairs, not realizing she had just saved her own life. I had a key, so I used it. There was no point in doing anything overtly suspicious in case anyone else should have seen me. And then I was inside my office. I didn't know what I'd been expecting. That was a problem now. Expectation. There were no reference points. Everything was new, the immediate archetype of how things were, at least here. So, an office. A static chair behind a static desk. A window with the blinds down. Books filling nearly three of the walls. There was a brown-leaved pot plant on the windowsill, smaller and thirstier than the one I had seen at the hospital. On the desk there were photos in frames amidst a chaos of papers and unfathomable stationery, and there, in the centre of it all, was the computer. I didn't have long, so I sat down and switched it on. This one seemed only fractionally more advanced than the one I'd used back at the house. Earth computers were still very much at the pre-sentient phase of their evolution, just sitting there and letting you reach in and grab whatever you wanted without even the slightest complaint. I quickly found what I was looking for, a document called Zeta. I opened it up and saw it was 26 pages of mathematical symbols, or most of it was. At the beginning, there was a little introduction written in words which said, "Proof of the Riemann Hypothesis." As you will know, the proof of the Riemann hypothesis is the most important unsolved problem in mathematics. To solve it would revolutionize applications of mathematical analysis in a myriad of unknowable ways that would transform our lives and those of future generations. Indeed, it is mathematics itself which is the bedrock of civilization, at first evidenced by architectural achievements such as the Egyptian pyramids and by astronomical observations essential to architecture. Since then, our mathematical understanding has advanced, but never at a constant rate. Like evolution itself, there have been rapid advances and crippling setbacks along the way. If the Library of Alexandria had never been burned to the ground, it is possible to imagine that we would have built upon the achievements of the ancient Greeks to greater and earlier effect, and therefore it could have been in the time of a Cardano or a Newton or a Pascal that we first put a man on the moon. And we can only wonder where we would be, and at the planets we would have terraformed and colonized by the 21st century, which medical advances we would have made. Maybe if there had been no dark ages, no switching off of the light, we would have found a way never to grow old, to never die. People joke in our field about Pythagoras and his religious cult based on perfect geometry and other abstract mathematical forms. But if we are going to have religion at all, then a religion of mathematics seems ideal, because if God exists, then what is he but a mathematician? And so today we may be able to say we have risen a little closer towards our deity. Indeed, potentially we have a chance to turn back the clock and rebuild that ancient library so we can stand on the shoulders of giants that never were.
Primes. The document carried on in this excited way for a bit longer. I learned a little bit more about Bernhard Riemann, a painfully shy 19th-century German child prodigy who displayed exceptional skill with numbers from an early age before succumbing to a mathematical career and a series of nervous breakdowns which plagued his adulthood. I would later discover this was one of the key problems humans had with numerical understanding. Their nervous systems simply weren't up to it. Primes, quite literally, sent people insane, particularly as so many puzzles remained. They knew a prime was a whole number that could only be divided by one or itself, but after that they hit all kinds of problems. For instance, they knew that the total of all primes was precisely the same as the total of all numbers, as both were infinite. This was, for a human, a very puzzling fact, as surely there must be more numbers than prime numbers. So impossible was this to come to terms with, some people, on contemplating it, placed a gun into their mouth, pulled the trigger, and blew their brains out. Humans also understood that primes were very much like the Earth's air. The higher you went, the fewer of them there were. For instance, there were 25 primes below 100, but only 21 between 100 and 200, and only 16 between 1,000 and 1,100. However, unlike with the Earth's air, it didn't matter how high you went with prime numbers, as there were always some around. For instance, 2,097,593 was a prime, and there were millions between it and, say, 4 undecillion, 314 decillion, 398 nonillion, 832 octillion, 739 septillion, 895 sextillion, 727 quintillion, 932 quadrillion, 419 trillion, 750 billion, 374,600,193. So, the atmosphere of prime numbers covered the numerical universe. However, people had struggled to explain the apparently random pattern of primes. They thinned out, but not in any way that humans could fathom. This frustrated the humans very much. They knew that if they could solve this, they could advance in all kinds of ways, because prime numbers were the heart of mathematics, and mathematics was the heart of knowledge. Humans understood other things. Atoms, for instance. They had a machine called a spectrometer, which allowed them to see the atoms a molecule was made from. But they didn't understand primes the way they understood atoms, sensing that they would do so only if they could work out why prime numbers were spread out the way they were. And then, in 1859, at the Berlin Academy, the increasingly ill Bernhard Riemann announced what would become the most studied and celebrated hypothesis in all mathematics. It stated that there was a pattern, or at least there was one for the first 100,000 or so primes. And it was beautiful and clean, and it involved something called a zeta function, a kind of mental machine in itself, a complex-looking curve that was useful for investigating properties of primes. You put numbers into it, and they would form an order that no one had noticed before. A pattern. The distribution of prime numbers was not random. There were gasps when Riemann, mid-panic attack, announced this to his smartly dressed and bearded peers. They truly believed the end was in sight, and that in their lifetimes there would be a proof that worked for all prime numbers. But Riemann had only located the lock, he hadn't actually found the key, and shortly afterwards he died of tuberculosis. And as time went on, the quest became more desperate. Other mathematical riddles were solved in due course, things like Fermat's last theorem and the Poincaré conjecture, which left proof of the long-buried German's hypothesis as the last and largest problem to solve. The one that would be the equivalent of seeing atoms in molecules, or identifying the chemical elements of the periodic table. The one that would ultimately give humans supercomputers, explanations of quantum physics, and interstellar transportation. After getting to grips with all this, I then trawled through all the pages full of numbers, graphs, and mathematical symbols. This was another language for me to learn,
but it was an easier and more truthful one than the one I had learnt with the help of Cosmopolitan. And by the end of it, after a few moments of sheer terror, I was in quite a state. After that very last and conclusive omega, I was left in no doubt that the proof had been found, and the key had turned that all-important lock. So, without so much as a second's thought, I deleted the document, feeling a small rush of pride as I did so. "There," I told myself, "you may have just managed to save the universe." But of course, things are never that simple, not even on Earth. The distribution of prime numbers. I looked at Andrew Martin's emails, specifically the very last one in his sent folder. It had the subject heading 153 years later, and it had a little red exclamation mark beside it. The message itself was a simple one. "I have proved the Riemann hypothesis, haven't I? Need to tell you first. Please, Daniel, cast your eyes over this. Oh, and needless to say, this is for those eyes only at the moment, until it goes public. What do you reckon? Humans will never be the same again? Biggest news anywhere since 1905? See attachment." The attachment was the document I had deleted elsewhere and had just been reading, so I didn't waste much time on that. Instead, I looked at the recipient. Daniel.Russell@cambridge.ac.uk. Daniel Russell, I swiftly discovered, was the Lucasian Professor of Mathematics at Cambridge University. He was 63 years old. He had written 14 books, most of which had been international bestsellers. The internet told me he had taught at every English language university with an intimidating enough reputation, Cambridge, where he was now, Oxford, Harvard, Princeton and Yale, among others, and had received numerous awards and titles. He had worked on quite a few academic papers with Andrew Martin, but as far as I could tell from my brief research, they were colleagues more than friends. I looked at the time. In about 20 minutes my wife would be coming home and wondering where I was. The less suspicion there was at this stage, the better. There was a sequence of doing things, after all. I had to follow the sequence. And the first part of the sequence needed to be done right now, so I trashed the email in the attachment. Then, to be on the safe side, I quickly designed a virus, yes, with the help of primes, which would ensure that nothing could be accessed intact from this computer again. Before I left, I checked the papers on the desk. There was nothing there to be worried about. Insignificant letters, timetables, blank pages. But then on one of them, a telephone number, 0786554-2187. I put it in my pocket and noticed as I did so one of the photographs on the desk. Isabel, Andrew, and the boy I assumed to be Gulliver. He had dark hair and was the only one of the three who wasn't smiling. He had wide eyes peeping out from below a dark fringe of hair. He carried the ugliness of his species better than most. At least he wasn't looking happy about what he was, and that was something. Another minute had gone by. It was time to go. "We are pleased with your progress, but now the real work must begin." "Yes." "Deleting documents from computers is not the same as deleting lives, even human lives."
"I understand that."
"A prime number is strong. It does not depend on others. It is pure and complete and never weakens. You must be like a prime. You must not weaken. You must distance yourself, and you must not change after interaction. You must be indivisible."
"Yes, I will be."
"Good. Now, continue." Glory. Isabel was still not back on my return to the house, so I did a little more research. She was not a mathematician, she was a historian. On Earth, this was an important distinction, as here, history was not yet viewed as a subdivision of mathematics, which of course it was. I also discovered that Isabel, like her husband, was considered to be very clever by the standards of her species. I knew this because one of the books on the shelf in the bedroom was The Dark Ages, the one I had seen in the bookshop window, and now I could see it had a quote from a publication called The New York Times, which read, "Very clever." The book was 1,253 pages long. A door opened downstairs. I heard the soft sound of metal keys being rested on a wooden chest. She came up to see me. That was the first thing she did. "How are you?" she asked. "I've been looking at your book, about the Dark Ages." She laughed. "What are you laughing at?"
"Oh, it's that or cry."
"Listen," I said, "do you know where Daniel Russell lives?"
"Of course I do. We've been to his house for dinner."
"Where does he live?"
"In Babraham. He's got a whopping place. Can you seriously not remember? It's like not remembering a visit to Nero's palace."
"Yes, I can, I can. It's just that there are things which are still a bit hazy. I think it's the pills." That was a blank, so that's why I asked. That's all. "So I'm good friends with him?"
"No, you hate him. You can't stand him. Though deep hostility is your default setting with other academics these days. Ari accepted."
"Ari?" She sighed.
"Your best friend."
"Oh, Ari. Yes, of course. Ari. My ears are a bit blocked. I didn't hear you properly."
"But with Daniel," she said, speaking a little louder, "if I dare say it, the hatred is just the manifestation of an inferiority complex on your part. But superficially you get on with him. You've even sought his guidance a few times with your prime number stuff."
"Right. Okay. My prime number stuff. Yes. And where am I with that? Where was I when I last spoke to you? Before?" I felt the urge to ask it outright. "Had I proved the Riemann hypothesis?"
"No, you hadn't. At least not that I knew. But you should probably check that out, because if you have, we'll be £1,000,000 richer."
"What?"
"Dollars, actually, isn't it?"
"I..."
"The Millennium Prize, or whatever it is. Proof of the Riemann hypothesis is the largest remaining puzzle that hasn't been solved. There's an institute in Massachusetts, the other Cambridge, the Clay Institute. You know this stuff backwards, Andrew. You mumble this stuff in your sleep."
"Absolutely. Backwards and forwards, all the ways. I just need a little reminding, that is all."
"Well, it's a very wealthy institute. They obviously have a lot of money, because they've already given about $10 million away to other mathematicians. Apart from that last guy."
"Last guy?"
"The Russian. Grigori something. The one who turned it down for solving the whatever it was conjecture."
"But $1 million is a lot of money, isn't it?"
"It is. It's a nice amount."
"So why did he turn it down?"
"How do I know? I don't know. You told me he was a recluse who lives with his mother. There are people in this world who have motives that extend beyond the financial, Andrew."
This was genuinely news to me. "Are there?"
"Yes, there are. Because, you know, there's this new groundbreaking and controversial theory that money can't buy you happiness."
"Oh," I said. She laughed again. She was trying to be funny, I think, so I laughed too. "So no one has solved the Riemann hypothesis?"
"What? Since yesterday?"
"Since, well, ever?"
"No. No one has solved it. There was a false alarm a few years back, someone from France, but no, the money is still there."
"So that is why he... why I... this is what motivates me, money." She was now arranging socks on the bed in pairs. It was a terrible system she had developed.
"Not just that," she went on. "Glory is what motivates you. Ego. You want your name everywhere. Andrew Martin, Andrew Martin, Andrew Martin. You want to be on every Wikipedia page going. You want to be an Einstein. The trouble is, Andrew, you're still 2 years old."
This confused me. "I am? How is that possible?"
"Your mother never gave you the love you needed. You will forever be sucking at a nipple that offers no milk. You want the world to know you. You want to be a great man."
She said this in quite a cool tone. I wondered if this was how people always talk to each other, or if it was just unique to spouses. I heard a key enter a lock. Isabel looked at me with wide, astonished eyes.
Gulliver!
Dark Matter. Gulliver's room was at the top of the house, the attic, the last stop before the thermosphere. He went straight there, his feet passing the bedroom I was in, with only the slightest pause before climbing the final set of stairs. While Isabel went out to walk the dog, I decided to phone the number on the piece of paper in my pocket. Maybe it was Daniel Russell's number.
Hello?
Came a voice. Female.
Who's this?
This is Professor Andrew Martin, I said. The female laughed.
Well, hello, Professor Andrew Martin.
Who are you? Do you know me?
You're on YouTube. Everyone knows you now. You've gone viral. The Naked Professor.
Oh.
Hey, don't worry about it. Everyone loves an exhibitionist.
She spoke slowly, lingering on words as if each one had a taste she didn't want to lose. Please, how do I know you? The question was never answered because at that precise moment Gulliver walked into the room and I switched off the phone. Gulliver, my son, the dark-haired boy I had seen in the photographs. He looked as I had expected, but maybe taller. He was nearly as tall as me. His eyes were shaded by his hair. Hair by